Yes, I'm talking about a nonviolent revolution of consciousness. A consciousness that is able to understand how we're all inextricably connected to each other on this earth and to the earth itself. And that if we violate those fundamental principles, we do so at our own peril. Yes, we can continue to live in this delusion and the denials of reality because it's painful. It's frightening. Sometimes it's terrifying. It's terrifying to face the truth. So I ask each of you to search your hearts as to what your truth is for being a citizen of the earth, promoting justice as a foundation for peace. It's not going to happen magically, and I think it's not going to happen by relying on these political structures and institutions. I think we're going to have to wage peace in the most extraordinary ways, whether our government wants it or not. You will know in your heart what to do, but I know that without a nonviolent revolution of consciousness, we will not survive as a civilization or as a planet. We can choose to have peace if we want to pay the price. And what more glorious goal and value do we want than peace for all people? And so I look forward to working together with you all, with we the people, to build a new society, a society that understands that we are not worth more and they are not worth less, and that we will be willing to pay the price and take the risks to wage peace with all fellow and sister human beings.
You let one ant stand up to us, then they all might stand up. Those puny little ants outnumber us 100 to 1. And if they ever figure that out, there goes our way of life.
The problem in the past has been the man turning us against one another. We have been unable to see the truth, because we have been fighting for 10 square feet of ground. Our turf. Our little piece of turf. It's crap, crap, brothers.
Since they're just things, I don't suppose you might let us take a quick look-see inside your bag.
Oh, I very much mind, Annie. There's no such thing as a quick invasion of civil liberty.
Oh, it all starts with a quick look-see into someone's bag, and then it's a brisk peek-a-rooney at our phone records, and before you can say, the thought police are forcing you to bend and spread.
Bend and spread? Are the thought police going to make love to us?
Welcome to the gross business of martial law. Welcome to what used to be individuality, seized and disintegrated by cowardly groupthink. Welcome, my friends. Welcome to the machine.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of School of Thought. I'm very, very honored and I'm very happy to have joining me today somebody who I discovered recently, but super excited to have you on. You can check him out at livefreefm.com. He's got his own podcast, Live Free FM. And you could also find him on Facebook. But Mr. Nathan Fraser, how are you doing today, sir?
Pretty good. And I am very grateful for you having me on as well.
Thanks, man. I really appreciate that. So for people that don't know, Nathan, like, you definitely, I don't, it's funny that I'm recording. It's like, oh, how do I want to talk to Nathan Fraser today? I heard you first on Red Ice Radio. That was actually the first episode I ever heard, but you just dropped court knowledge. And anybody that's listened to this podcast, I've had a couple freemen on who've been pretty inspirational and who kind of do the freemen movement the right way. But at the same time, being in the United States, something I noticed, and I don't know if you noticed this too, Nathan, just because you said you studied it as well, it seems like most of the people in the freeman movement are in England or Canada or somewhere that's not the United States. And as soon as I think about applying, I'm like, man, they would just beat the hell out of you in the United States if you tried that on them. If you gave a cop an affidavit, I just feel like they just abuse you. So if you want to talk about your journey and your court experience, that'd be awesome.
So I guess to start off as an introduction for myself, I come from probably not the typical background of of a libertarian or anarcho-capitalist or whatever blanket statement or title that you want to put on me. But I came from very low income background. I grew up on welfare. I grew up in predominantly low income neighborhoods, and I saw probably 95% of my friends, including myself, go to jail for victimless crimes. And after 9/11 happened, and I started kind of researching the nefarious undertones of our current political system, and then I guess kind of the philosophy of politics altogether, I started getting very upset with the way that I saw things going, and I was getting actually kind of that deer in the headlights look that you get when you listen to a lot of the alternative media out there. I kind of started suffering from that and feeling very hopeless, and all the while more and more of my friends are going to prison for victimless crimes. And and this is probably something that is familiar feeling to a lot of people. I wanted to start finding solutions for all of the problems that I was seeing that the legal system was creating. And as I started noticing that they were expanding their reach, and things like the Patriot Act and things like the War on Terror were basically turning even more people into victimless criminals. And it was no longer it was growing up for me. It was a problem that I dealt with my whole life. People going to prison for things that didn't hurt anybody, things like drug possession, things like gun possession, all kinds of different. I mean, everything's pretty much illegal nowadays. And when 9/11 happened, it seemed like we were on the fast road to a society that I did not want to see my society turn into. And so I started looking for solutions in the legal system. And like yourself, and like probably many people listening to this podcast and many people not listening to it, I found a lot of like the sovereignty free man gurus out there and started implementing the things that they were preaching. I studied probably every big name guru out there. I studied probably for about 3 or 4 years, and maybe not that long, maybe about 2 years, 3 years. And then I started implementing the things that I had quote unquote learned from them, and kept hitting brick walls. And I kept trying over and over again. I'd go to court on my own things. I'd help other people with, help in quotes again. I'd try to help other people who were taking on their own court cases, and spent a lot of time in forums for sovereignty and free man and commercial redemption and all of that stuff, and just hit multiple brick walls, and didn't really give up on it. But when something doesn't work 3 or 4 times in a row, you tend to not focus on it and you try to move on. And luckily, I met a cat named Mark Stevens, and I met another guy. I'll use his YouTube name. He goes by the name Tactical Guy One. And I spent lots of time talking with both of them and studying all of their material. And since implementing the processes that they were doing, which is very much more – a lot of the things that the legal gurus out there in sovereignty land and free man land, a lot of the stuff that they teach, you can't find any of it in any kind of law books. You can't find any of it. You can't find validation, or, you know, you're hearing this is what you got to do, but you get half of a process and you go looking for the logic behind it. You go looking for the reason why it should work, and there's nothing. There's nothing in the codes. There's nothing in the statutes. There's nothing in the rules of procedure or the rules of evidence that backs up or verifies or explains better the things that these people are preaching. So That was the big thing that was really different about what I learned from Mark and what I learned from Tactical Guy. One is that everything that they were talking about was very clearly right there in black and white in the rules of procedure, in the rules of evidence, in the rules of the court. And when I started implementing the types of approaches that they were taking into what I was doing, the brick walls started just crumbling. And I still to this day don't win every single case that I take on, but at least like 70 to 80% of the times that myself or people that come to me asking what I would do in their situation, about 70 to 80% of the time, it results with either the case being dismissed or the case being closed with a satisfactory resolution.
That's pretty incredible, seeming as though, like, I heard you talking about, I'm in the same boat. Like, I don't condone drinking and driving, but I was one of those people who I got pulled over and there was no impaired driving. Supposedly I stopped in front of my stop sign. I stopped beyond the line, and the video evidence showed that I had not. But where I messed up was I cried like a little bitch, and I was in such a bad way when it came to drinking that in reality it was a good thing that happened to me. But then I found out, like, during my I don't know how you guys do it in Colorado, but like here in Ohio we have to do, like, you have like a weekend where you go with all the other drunk people. And then I heard, like, yeah, I fell asleep behind the wheel, and I was driving the wrong way down the highway, and I crashed my car. I'm lucky to be alive. And I'm like, man, like, this is insane. And then a lawyer comes in and talks to us and says how the cop who actually gave me my DUI brags about pulling over 44 cars a night. And it's just like, to me, it was just like, it put a bad taste in my mouth, because there's a lot of, like, especially with a lot of law and DUI law, like, for me, it's been, you know, it's based on the cop's discretion whether or not you have a DUI. So even if you do blow it, the cop could still say that, oh, well, we felt that they were still impaired. And then I went and I paid a lawyer $3,500, who did get my sentence reduced. But 70 to 80% not paying a lawyer, that's pretty damn good, honestly. So,
yeah. Well, and this is the thing that I've noticed is lawyers have their hands tied. A lot of people ask me why I don't go to law school and why I don't go become a lawyer. And it's because I wouldn't be able to bring up the issues that I bring up in court. I attack the very foundation of what they're doing. They want to claim that they have the right to write rules for me and that I'm obligated to follow them. They have the burden of proof, and I'm going to hold them to the burden of proof. And I want to know what facts, evidence, and witnesses that they are going to use to meet the burden of proof to prove that their little opinions that they wrote down on pieces of paperwork actually apply to how I'm allowed to live my life. And I feel like as long as I'm not hurting anybody or anybody that I talk to that gets in trouble for all these victimless crimes, as long as you're not injuring anybody, as long as you're not impeding on your rights, if the state comes after you, that's their aggression on your rights. And I attack the very foundation of why they think they have the right to do that. And as a lawyer, I think that if I tried to do that, I'd probably get accused of harassing the bar, or I'd probably get my license taken away, which would be like $80,000 in 6 years of my life just down the drain. So I haven't gone to law school, but I do talk to defending attorneys and prosecuting attorneys, and, you know, outside of my own cases, and just talk to them about my philosophy. And a lot of times they actually agree with me, but I don't think that any of them would ever have the cojones to try and do what I do in court, because it would probably end up resulting in their ability to practice law being revoked.
That's so fascinating. It's just such a, I mean, the more I hear, and the more like my eyes are open to just our farce of a system. Anyways, I mean, like, we're in a government shutdown right now, and like right on Facebook, someone's like, yeah, you know, good luck having your trash picked up. And it's like, so we need government so we have our trash taken away? I don't really think so. And it's like, I think it's just fascinating to me, like, the amount of I guess the amount of social conditioning that we've been subjected to, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, yeah, absolutely. And the thing about it is I think it was Harriet Tubman, I believe. I might be wrong. It might have been somebody else, but somebody that was instrumental in the Underground Railroad wrote that they had helped free 1,000 slaves, and they could have helped free 1,000 more if only they realized that they were slaves. It's kind of like the fish in the water. When you grow up in this society and you're not ever able to step back and look at it from a third person point of view, when you're constantly living inside of the water, you become oblivious to the fact that water's all around you. So when you're constantly living under the oppression of the most organized criminal gang in the world, which I would say is government, and not just our government, but all government in general, when you grow up believing that all of society's difficult problems have to be solved by this criminal organization, and you're constantly fed that, it's reinforced through your education, it's reinforced through everybody that you know, because they've never learned anything different. It's kind of like the fish in the water. You don't realize how insane society is because you're completely immersed in it your entire life. But when somebody kind of pulls you up out of the water and makes you look at the lake from up above it, it's really hard to go to jump back into the lake of insanity and go back to living in that old reality.
Yeah, no, 100%. I think the first thing for me, which kind of started to wake me up, and like something that you said was earlier, I think Zeitgeist was like the first film that I watched that I was like, whoa, 9/11's fake. Like that wasn't real. Or whoa, Christianity's based on a bunch of other different religions. And it was just kind of like, it just kind of like blew my gourd. And then I watched, I started watching and listening to Alex Jones. And then you start to see his agenda take place. And, I just think it's interesting, even amongst like people who challenge our government and everything else like that, like just the blend of, there's very few, I feel like, people that have like a pure message of anarchism that isn't necessarily, doesn't necessarily have an agenda behind it besides, hey, I really want to help you look at things differently. Or I really want you to start thinking for yourselves. Besides, the guys at Tragedy and Hope really do a good job of that. And I think Larkin Rose and yourself do as well. I mean, I think like hearing all of you guys kind of shine the light on what government really is and what anarchism really is. It's been super refreshing for me and inspirational. Sorry about that, Nathan. I just really gave you a huge compliment there, and sometimes that's awkward. But I just feel like a compliment has to be given, and what's interesting to me is a lot of people that don't even know who you are yet, and I think like you have such a strong message, and I think it's so I guess I just want to say thank you again, man. Anyways, to make it less awkward, Nathan. like, what do you, in your opinion, like, why do you think, I guess not why do you think that is, but I mean, it's just like, I feel like David Icke talks about lizard people and then there's so much other stuff, and it's just like, well, David Icke says a lot of stuff, but then he also, I mean, it was funny seeing him on Jesse Ventura's conspiracy theory, but then you look at Jesse Ventura and it's like, okay, what's that guy's agenda? And it's always like it's and sometimes I really feel like it's just entertainment, like they're doing it to entertain us, not necessarily in like the control just kind of happens. But I'm not like, I don't always know, like it's just like it's a tricky thing for me to filter.
Well, and the thing is I feel you 100%. The thing is when you're going through all of this, you've always got in the back of your mind, what are these people's real agenda? Because once you start realizing that the people that you've put blind trust in your entire life, like your educators and your news broadcasters and your parents, you start realizing that some of those people had ulterior motives. Your parents maybe weren't evil in their misleading you of how reality was. They were just they were misled and they continued misleading you. Your educators, some of them probably were deliberately misleading you because it made it easier for them to do their jobs. You start looking at things like MK Ultra and you realize that the media has been used to deliberately mislead people. You look at things like Project Mockingbird and you start realizing that some people out there that you've trusted have deliberately misled you for one reason or another. So any new information, now that you have that knowledge that in the past people that you blindly trusted had either alternative agendas or they were ignorantly passing on bad information to you. So then you have to start asking, well, this new information that I'm getting, how do I avoid falling victim to that same set of circumstances? And then you start looking at everybody that is out there. And so, yeah, you do have to wonder, you know, is this guy saying this stuff that's crazy? The Queen of England transforms into a lizard and drinks blood out of a cup. Is he saying this because he really believes it, or is he saying it because he's got a target audience and he needs to stick within that target audience's what they find is acceptable? Is he saying it because he wants to sell books? Because obviously the guy's not an idiot. Yeah. He says a lot of smart stuff, but when he goes off to this area where I just can't, you know, I don't find enough evidence to buy a hook, line, and sinker, what is his reasoning for doing this? Or when you look at other people that, you know, they're telling you a little bit half truth, sometimes they're exaggerating for effect. You have to wonder, is this guy just exaggerating because he needs good ratings, or is he exaggerating because he's literally that paranoid, or is he exaggerating because he's trying to get me in such a state of fear where, like I mentioned earlier, the deer in the headlights, is this guy exposing me to the truth, but doing it in a way that makes me feel completely helpless, because that's his goal, is to make me feel completely helpless. So you got to start, you don't have to, but a lot of people that start going down this rabbit hole, it ends up being that you're a lot more skeptical of the new information, and you do have to kind of sort through what people's agendas are.
Yeah, it's interesting. Whenever I think of the deer in headlights and the scare, I always think it's so I can buy those prepackaged meals or those gusset jeans or those generators or the commercials that he has, whose name I'm not going to say because I do respect the guy, but I just think it's funny. I totally. And I think I feel like just recently studying the Trivium more and then hearing the guy from Tragedy and Hope you just had on your podcast, and anybody who hasn't listened to it, please check out
Daryl Becker.
Yeah, Daryl Becker. I mean, it was fascinating to hear that guy talk. I mean, that guy is brilliant in his presentation, talking about the way he communicates, nonviolent communication. And that was something that was totally new to me, because like I'll hear Jan, and like I like Jan Irvin a lot. I've had him as a guest. But Jan is just like, don't fuck with Jan. Like, that's kind of his attitude. Like, don't fuck with me. Like, I'm doing this. And I respect the hell out of him for it. But at the same time, like, I discovered Jan through, like, Joe Rogan's podcast. And, like, Rogan, like, kind of – I mean, it wasn't very – he didn't treat him very well. And then when Jan started talking about Terrence McKenna, it was like, oh, he attacked their demigod. So he's, like, had to face, like, all this stuff. And I think the whole – It's like, for me, like being on the internet, like I find these different communities, and within the community, there's just deeper and deeper layers to people that it's just like, it's what's interesting to me is it's like everybody's like, okay, well, I don't believe in this, I don't believe in that, but this person, this is my new demigod, or this is my new religion. And I think it's fascinating because hearing you talk about our government being a religion to people, and then I've heard you in a recording say that from at least a year and a half ago, and then South Park pretty much just comes out and does the same thing last week. I think it's fascinating, man. I think it's fascinating for us, like for humans to want to believe. Like, I personally do believe in a creator. I'm not sure what it is, but I don't have anything to worship, if that makes sense. And I feel like people want to have that, and I'm not sure if that's conditioned or if that's just instinctual or what's going on there.
I think it's a little bit of both. I think that a lot of times when we look at the the way things are and the people that manipulate and take advantage of the way things are, a lot of times it's a little bit of column A and a little bit of column B. There's a little bit of human instinct or human natural reaction. And then there's people that realize, hey, I can utilize this. I can manipulate this. So when it comes to things like, and I don't bash any particular religion, I am probably similar to you. I guess agnostic. I believe that there's probably some sort of creative force to the universe. It seems that that's the logical conclusion as to why things work so perfectly and harmoniously together. At the same time, though, I see almost every single religion that I've ever studied as being a system of control. And I don't think that the people that organized any religion that I've ever looked at had the intention of exposing people to the true nature of the creator of the universe, rather as a way to set up a brain controlling system to keep the masses of their community under control and to make sure that they were able to live fat. And the state is the natural progression of that same idea. So the same psychological downfalls that led people to search for the shaman in the tribe, then eventually the priest in the church, and then up until modern times, the king, the queen, or the president. The same things that that caused people to look for those leaders. It's something that's probably in a lot of people. People want answers, and they want the answers easy. That's why the news is so popular. That's why 30-second sound clips are more popular than an actual in-depth look at something. It's why people would prefer to have somebody just summarize a book for them rather than go read it themselves. Not everybody, I don't want to make a blanket statement, but people like somebody that can give them quick, easy answers. And people that realize that they can gain one up on providing quick, simple, easy answers, and at the same time realize that, hey, there's thousands of years of how to manipulate my fellow man that's been archived and occulted away to small groups of people. I can lie and provide false answers, and I can live off of the worship of other people. And that's what leads people to create the state. That's what leads people to follow the state, just like it led people to create most of the religions of the world, if not all of them, and led almost everybody to follow those same religions.
Yeah, it's and at the same time too, and I don't want to say that, because man, I have a lot of good friends that are really, and they're people that I would consider to be my good friends. And I think it's, you know, they look at their religion as a guide for values and principles, which I respect. But I think at the same time, you don't necessarily need that to be a good person. And I think it's something that I did have a point here, Nathan, and I just totally forgot what I was making a point of. But like, I think it's for me, like growing up Catholic, I mean, it's definitely control. I mean, didn't the Vatican say, you know, give me a boy before the age of five and I can control him for the rest of his life? I think somebody said that, or I forget who said that. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I've heard the quote before. I don't know if it's specifically applied to somebody within the Catholic Church, but I will say that the Catholic Church is probably the first organization that perfected, or at least made a well-rounded mind control system that was applicable to large masses of people. I think that a lot of what we see governments and other nefarious organizations do today, the Catholic Church was probably one of the first organizations that really mastered it. And a lot of the modern secret societies and other religions and or other organizations blatantly and unabashedly admit that they ordered their own organizations by modeling them after the order of the Jesuits. So what the Jesuits were able to accomplish, and probably still accomplishing has been instrumental in the populist manipulations that we see going on nowadays.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy. Well, sorry, Nathan. For some reason, I'm just goofy today. I don't know. Maybe it was a big long talk about football, but yeah. What do you think of getting on Facebook, seeing people talk about this government shutdown? Like what? Like to me, it's exciting to see the government shutdown because it's like. I guess even like what's interesting to me is, you know, Detroit pretty much, I mean, they have cops robbing people, but honestly, like, you know, I'm not saying I want to hang out in Detroit a lot, but I'm from around Detroit originally, like Northwest Ohio. And, you know, most people in Detroit that are just hanging out, I mean, they kind of do look out for each other. I'm not saying like drug users or anything, like people that are like heavy into like serious drugs or anything, but you know, from my experience there, I'm not saying there's definitely areas I want to avoid, but it's, you know, I feel like a lot of good things are actually going to come out of the city collapsing in a weird way, because I feel like it's going to have to regulate itself, which ultimately I think is the goal. Like for me personally, for our societies, you know, let's remove the illusions of police and let's remove this gangster government that we have. What are your thoughts on everything about everything I just said, Nathan? What's your thoughts there? What's your thoughts?
I think there's actually a lot of inspiring things happening right now in Detroit. There's private police agencies that are serving the community 1,000 times better than the public police ever did. They're one of the ones that is a great example of it is a guy, I believe his name is Dale Brown, and he started up his own private police service out there and is predominantly aimed at lower income neighborhoods. He takes the exact opposite approach that the state police do. He doesn't go into a situation trying to establish authority or escalate the situation to the point where he's in control or his employees are in control. They do the exact opposite. They try to de-escalate the fact is about running a business, violence is bad for business. And if you have a business where you can collect money, no matter how violent you get, then it doesn't matter. But when you have a business that relies on happy customers and good word of mouth, then violently oppressing people doesn't do very well. So he's providing the same service that the state promises to provide in the police. But since he's not tax funded and since he has to make his customers happy, and since he has to rely on good word of mouth to attract new customers, he's taking an exact opposite approach than what the state did in protecting, and he's doing a much better job. The other thing is when you look at things like Hurricane Katrina, when you look at 9/11, when you look at here in Colorado, we just had a whole bunch of massive flooding like 2-3 weeks ago. And the amount of grassroots people sprouting up to help people in need is amazing. And when you turn on the news, all you're bombarded with is how evil humans are and how horrible human beings can treat each other. And therefore, we need to have antidepressants and we need to have a government to regulate us all. But in reality, when these situations happen, 9/11 is a great example. You saw how many people poured out every penny they could spare to help the families that were victimized in 9/11. Katrina, the same thing. You had churches and community organizers going down there and trying to bring blankets and clean water. And then you've got this group of people called the government and their agencies like FEMA stopping people and saying, you can't do it. Only the Red Cross can come in and do it. So the fact of the matter is human beings do look out for each other. Human beings in times of tragedy, in times of downtroddenness, in times of emergency will come together and help each other. And the government, quote unquote, the people that call themselves government, they want the monopoly. They want to convince us that only they can provide it for us. And when you look at the reality of the situation, is we can provide it for ourselves. Everything the government does for us, anything that's valuable, people will be able to provide that for each other. And when you look at things like 9/11 and Hurricane Katrina and how churches were turned away and told to take their water and leave, and told to take their food and leave. And there was an anarchist group, a leftist anarchist group, in the flood that happened in New York a couple years back, and they gathered all kinds of food and blankets and water and candles and flashlights, and tried to bring it to the victims up in New York when that hurricane hit. And FEMA stopped them at gunpoint and told them to turn around. And so the government wants to enforce that they're the only ones that can do that. And the reality of the situation is, and Detroit is showing it, and so many examples have shown it over and over again, we as a community of voluntary individuals can do a much better job than the government ever could. But they have to keep us afraid. They have to keep us thinking that we never could. And then that way we'll accept their not quite as good product that they provide.
Yeah, Chris Christie, that guy. Like, I don't know. I think sometimes, like, I catch myself like being heavy into politics, and I've slowly been able to remove myself. But at the same time, like, it is kind of entertaining, but it's like you get trapped. It's like a way to suck you in and watch the, as Jesse Ventura says, the Washington Wrestling Federation. Hands down, absolutely. I mean, the government, it's funny to me because, like, some people, it's not like it's actually good that I feel like these past 16 years of really just open pretty much dictator presidents, like, has been really good for waking people up. And I don't even like saying waking people up just because of the connotation that's been put on that. But I feel like more and more people are starting to care. And do you think, like, just like Obama, like his speech that he had about why we need to invade Syria, and even though it was 91% of the people didn't think we should go to war. And I think, like, the whole idea is, I think more and more people, and I think it's largely because of the internet, are starting to catch on and say, you know, government's not necessarily the answer. And I think, you know, it's interesting to see guys like Ron and Rand Paul come up, because I think I heard Gino Denning talk about it, and I heard him say, I forget what exactly he said about Ron Paul, but, like, Ron Paul he serves a purpose to kind of fit those people. Does that make sense? I'm sorry, I'm all over the place,
no,
Nathan.
No, that's cool. You mentioned Jesse Ventura and the Worldwide Federation of Wrestling, or whatever. Yeah, the point is Washington is a puppet show to keep us. If they didn't have the illusion of choice, if they didn't have the illusion of representative government, then we would realize that we have slavery, and that's the reality of what it is. Politics is slavery. Politics is one person saying, I have the right to write this down on a piece of paper, alter the way that everybody else lives their lives, and anybody that wants to resist the new way that they have to live by dictate of what I wrote down on a piece of paper, I have the right to kill that person. That's what politics is. And democracy is so successful because it gives us politics is a gun, and dictatorships are one guy holding the gun at everybody else. Democracy gives us the illusion that we get to fight over which way the gun should be pointed. So when the left have their president in office, they get to point the gun at the right and force the people on, you know, shoot at the feet of the people at the right and tell them what kind of a dance they want them to do. And when the right gets their guy in office, then they get to put their hands on the gun and do the same thing. But the fact is we just get a little bit of direction in which way the gun points, but we never really get control over the gun. They keep control over the gun. They keep control over, you know, who pays what in taxes, and who gets to do what, and who gets what subsidies, and who gets thrown in jail for what. If we stopped falling for the two-party little representative scheme that they got going on, if we stopped watching the wrestling match and stopped being entertained by it, we would, the reality of how enslaved we are would be right there in our face. And if that ever happened, then the legitimacy of those people would be out the window. We would no longer look at them as legitimate. And that's where their real power comes from. Yeah, they've got the guns. Yeah, they're willing to resort to use the guns. But as long as we see them as a legitimate ruling class, then they will stay the ruling class. A lot of people are starting to wake up to the illegitimacy of the government, and a lot of people are starting to tune out. And those people, if you know, the more people tune out, the more people that stop watching the wrestling, the less effect the wrestling is going to have over the minds of people altogether. And if people start turning off the show and the show starts losing ratings, then the wrestlers, i.e. the politicians, they lose all of their power. They lose all of their influence. So when people start turning off the show, they need to figure out what they can do. And this is just my opinion. This is me looking at human nature and how it works in the corporate world and applying it to how it works in the political world. But if WWF or WWE, I think it's called now, if they only had one type of wrestler, they had the pretty boy wrestler, and he got up and fought against the other pretty boy wrestler, that would get boring really quick and people would turn off the TV. So they have a wrestler to match each part of their audience. They've got the Mexican wrestler with all the tattoos. They've got the black wrestler that comes from the junkyard. They've got the white wrestler who's a pretty boy. They've got the white wrestler who looks like a goth guy. They've got the hillbilly wrestler. They've got a wrestler for each target member of their audience to keep everybody tuning in. And so politics, in my opinion, has to work the same way. Otherwise, people would stop tuning in. And that's the worst thing that could happen, is if we lose our interest in politics, if we lose our vision of them being as our legitimate rulers, then they lose all of their power. So they have to employ the same methods that the WWF is employing, and that is make sure that there's a character for everybody. And as more and more people realize that the government is getting more and more tyrannical, more and more people are going to be looking for solutions. Well, if the problem is politics and the real solution is to ignore and no longer see politics as legitimate, politics does not want that as being your solution. So what they're going to do is they're going to create a fraudulent or an alternative solution that they can still control, that's still within their political game. So they want you to think that the answer to politics can be solved by somebody within politics. And the way that they do that, the way that they keep you tuning in each week, is to make sure that there's a wrestler for you. So as the demographic of people who want freedom starts to grow, and the demographic of people who dislike government continues to grow, if they want to stay relevant, if they want to stay on the air, they need to make sure that they have wrestlers on the screen that are reflecting that sentiment, in order to keep the people who have just about given up on watching wrestling, they've got to keep them tuning in. So they have to create wrestlers that will keep those people coming back as well, because the worst thing that could possibly happen for them is for us to turn off our TVs. So they have to make sure that they keep our attention.
Yeah, that was exactly what I was trying to hint at, Nathan, and you crushed it. Thank you so much. it's just crazy. Like, it just is. It's crazy that it's been going on for so long, and it's like an elaborate magic trick. And I think that's what was great about wrestling as a kid, because everybody knows that it's fake, but it was the magic of it all. And I think, like, that's the thing with politics, is a lot of people don't realize that it's just a big show. And
well, imagine this, though. Imagine if Worldwide Federation of Wrestling, or WCW or WWE or whichever one, imagine if we handed over the education of our children to the WCW and we let them control 12 years of everything that they learned. How many children would, by the time they got to be 18 years old, how many children would be able to turn on a wrestling match and be able to say, that's fake?
That's so true. That's so true. Wow. That's amazing. I never even thought of it that way. It just goes deeper and deeper and deeper.
Wow, man, I'm kind of speechless right now, Nathan. Never really thought of it that way. I mean, this great wrestling analogy just kind of expanded on, and then looking at the education system. Wow, man, that's fascinating. Do you think technology is ultimately going to be one of the driving forces into? I think, you know, Cody R. Wilson has really made a pretty profound statement with the 3D guns. Do you think 3D technology is going to bring more types of revolutions? If that makes sense.
Yeah. So we'll take one step back and we'll just start with the internet before we get into 3D printers.
Cool.
I have this conversation with one of my buddies, the guy that I'm probably like the most tattooed guy in the whole Liberty movement. If you put me next to like 10 other mouthpieces in the Liberty movement, I'd be the one that stands out and people would be like, that guy does not belong. My tattoo artist is probably the only person I've ever met in real life who I would say is more intelligent than I am. And, me and him have lengthy conversations about all kinds of stuff, from religion to political philosophy to the nature of human interactions to whatever it may be. And one of the things that we constantly come back to is communication and how advancements in communication just completely mess up the whole power structure of whatever current society they happen to fall in. So at one point in time, people could just grunt and use body language, and that was all they could communicate with. And then people started labeling things in their minds and started attaching labels to things so that they could communicate ideas better with each other. And then language evolved from that. And at each point along the way, as ideas have new ways to be communicated to each other, and as the communication allows the idea to be spread. I mean, if you have a brilliant idea on how to make a fire, but you don't know how to communicate that to people, then you are the only one that benefits from fire. But as soon as you and everybody in your community has a shared symbolism through language, you can express how to make a fire, and now everybody in that community benefits from fire. And as soon as that is able to be communicated to people even further away, then, you know, it spreads like fire. So as communication and as steps and evolutions in communication happen, they have a tendency to completely disrupt the whole world. And you can see from caveman till now, every single major, look at taking what Martin Luther did with taking the Bible out of Latin or Aramaic and putting it into German so that the whole countryside could read rather than just be dictated to what was in the Bible. That had a revolutionary effect on that society. Right now, what we're watching with the internet, we're watching the very beginning steps of what could possibly be a revolutionary leap forward in communication. And so who knows exactly where we're going, but if where we're at right now is any indication of where we're going, the ability to spread ideas like you were mentioning, the Zeitgeist movement, or not movement, but the movie. I'm not a big fan of the movement, but I did like the first movie. That first movie, which was probably, when it first came out, was already knee deep in all this stuff for many, many years. But that first movie had the ability to reach people like you only because of the internet. And before the internet, people that were trying to get this message out were relying on literature that would get tucked away in libraries and hardly ever read, or shortwave radio broadcasts that were listened to by maybe 1,000 people, 10,000 people at the most. But internet has had the ability of making it to where people have been able to communicate these ideas to millions of other people. And it is showing a reflection. I mean, I don't know if you, I really don't watch very much TV, but I have a couple, guilty pleasures in TV. I like that Revolution show. And, I've watched the first couple episodes of this new show called Sleepy Hollow. And the amount of political pro-freedom message that's being put into these shows, and the symbolism, a lot of Masonic symbolism and other occulted symbolism keeps showing up in these new TV shows that never would have been there before. And it's because, in my opinion, I don't know, I'm not the guys writing these shows, but it's because these ideas are starting to have, they're starting to leak their way into the mainstream mindset. And I think that, that's absolutely to the detriment of the people that have been in control for so long. I think that they're slowly losing a iron-tight grasp that they've had on the minds of mankind for hundreds of thousands of years. And it seems like maybe not for everybody, but for a lot more people than I ever imagined possible. This is – I grew up not trusting the government ever. And when 9/11 happened, the day that it happened, I was suspicious of it. And I thought that there was something funny going on about it. And I didn't have internet at the time. And I searched and searched looking for other people saying the same thing. The only person that I could find at that time that was saying the same thing was Bill Cooper. And like 2 months after that, he was killed. So there wasn't anybody really out there saying these ideas that I was trying to explain to people. And to go from that 10 years ago or 12 years ago to the point now where 90% of my Facebook news feed is stuff that I was talking about 10 years ago, and people are starting to finally wake up to this stuff. That's if that's an indication of the effect that internet is going to have on communication, then I think that it's just going to continue. It's just going to continue to snowball. When it comes to things like 3D printers, 3D printers are an inevitable step, just like file sharing. And I think that 3D printers are going to make people – one of the things that I'm not a very big fan of is intellectual property and – the idea that government can grant monopoly rights on the expression of an idea and say nobody's allowed to copy what you did. I mean, to extend it logically to like fire or wheels, to think that you're not allowed to create a wheel because somebody else invented it first. So now you have to roll your cart around with a square wheel because somebody else patented the round wheel, or to think that you're not allowed to cook your meal with fire because somebody else invented the process of creating fire and they've got the legally granted monopoly on the use of fire. When it comes to things like 3D printers, once they become a household item and people realize, hey, my door handle busted on my car, I can either wait 3 weeks for Mazda to send me a new one for $30, or I can go on the Pirate Bay, download the CAD file and print myself out one in 30 minutes. People are going to start realizing, hey, this government monopoly grant, government granted monopoly on printing out door handles or whatever the copyrighted item might be, it's gonna make people start questioning that. And the ability to print out everything from guns to lamp holders to styluses for your notepad or whatever it may be, it's gonna completely mess up the retail service industry. It's going to completely change how a large part of the market is going to operate. And I'm all for it. Like I don't know where it's going to end up, but as long as it's completely voluntary, I'm all for it. I think that what we're going to see is a lot of the people that have owned and operated the exclusive rights to provide us with many things that we need in life, and people that have gotten extremely rich by utilizing the government and having the government attack anybody who tries to compete with them. I think that once the ability to compete with them is right there on your desktop, a lot of the powers that be that have established their monopoly force in the marketplace, they're going to end up back on a level playing field. And with information spreading the way it is, with file sharing spreading the way it is, with knowledge and education. You see free education popping up all over the internet for anything that you want to learn, even so much of just going onto YouTube and say, how do I do this? And I think that the staple points that the powers that be have used to keep society in control are quickly deteriorating right underneath their feet. And so while this may result in them taking some drastic measures, I think the genie's out of the bottle already, and wherever it's going to lead to, I have more hope than fear.
Yeah, I'm going to agree with you. I mean, I think it's easy to get scared, and I think a lot of times people fear the unknown, but I think I do believe, just like what you said earlier, like, people want to help other people. I think it's, you know, when people are put in a situation where they're not, when they have to survive and they're fighting to survive, that's genuine. That's generally the only time. I mean, you look at places like Africa. I was just watching some Vice special on the how ivory is really popular again in Africa. And it's like, well, yeah, no shit. I mean, all their labor is getting, you know, it's all slave labor over war minerals there. I mean, it's, nobody's getting to, there's no organization, and they don't want it to be organized. Like, does that make sense what I'm saying? Like when you put people in a bad situation, like the government often does, they typically have to act out in certain ways just to survive. If that makes sense.
Well, absolutely. And this is one of the things that I really harp on, actually, is the lifestyle that I grew up, the things that I did with my life 20 years ago, I wouldn't be caught dead doing now. The criminal activity that I was involved with, some of the more regretful things of my childhood, I grew up, like I said at the beginning, I grew up in very low income areas, and my dad was in and out of prison my whole life. I watched 90% of my friends go to prison. The other 10%, you know, I watched them die way too young, and I had a mentality that it was hopeless. There was no hope for me, and there was no way I was going to get a job. There was no way I was going to be successful in life. I came from, you know, the gutter. And even though you get sold these rags to riches stories, I didn't see that. I didn't see that as my future. And I saw my future as being just as hopeless as everybody else's future around me. And when you see a hopeless future for yourself, it doesn't make you stop and think, if I do this, how is this going to affect my future? Because I don't care, because my future is not roses anyways. I'm not going to go to college. I'm not going to be a CEO. I'm not going to be anything successful. I'm probably going to be dead or in prison by the time I'm 20. So what do I care about how this affects the future? And when you're in that hopeless mentality, which is in a large part created by government in the first place, the war on drugs and the war through regulation on competition against the big businesses and all of these different laws that the government passed that actually end up doing more harm to the lower income communities than good. When you grow up in that kind of a situation, and it's, I can't imagine that it's much different than the mindset of people in third world nations when they don't feel like they have any hope for their future at all, because they have, you know, gang warlords ruling over them, kidnapping their children, making them go mine for diamonds or whatever the case may be. When you're in that type of a situation and you have no hope for the future, there's no reason for you to think, how can I help my neighbors? How can I best get myself, you know, pick myself up by the bootstraps and get myself out of this situation? The only thing that you're thinking about is, well, there's no hope anyways. What can I do that's going to gratify me right now? And I don't care about the long-term effects of this. And so I think a lot of times, just from my own experience, just that sense of hopelessness completely alters your reality and completely alters how you react to situations and give people a sense of hope and take away all of the government-induced threats to their survival, and you'll see a completely different reaction from people.
That's awesome. That's awesome. What I tell you what, Nathan, we are very close to an hour. Thank you so much for giving me your time. Love to have you on again sometime if that would be cool. Just to have you expand on more ideas. I always love listening to what you have to say, man. I think I think something I heard you say before was learning to be nonviolent in your communication. Do you want to touch up on that right before we go? I think like just the importance, because you were talking about communication, and I just like I'd never heard of the concept of nonviolent communication until listening to you. So it's kind of a big thing for me right now.
Yeah, I think for myself, it's been one of those things that I took. People that listen to my show, a lot of times the topics that I choose to go over on my show are things that are relevant to my own life, and I'm hoping will find relevance in the listeners' lives. I don't think that I'm very much different from most people out there. I probably deal with the same personal problems. I deal with the same outwardly problems that most people deal with. And so a lot of times the show that I do, I try to focus on things that I've found solutions in my own life, and hopefully they can benefit the people listening. And one of the things that constantly comes up is, especially for people just getting into all of this stuff that's going on, is I cannot communicate this to people. Every time I try to talk with somebody, it turns into a fight. They tell me that I'm crazy. They won't listen to me. I run into brick walls. And I've got all of this information that I'm trying to get to. I care about these people. I want them to realize that they're in chains, and none of them want to hear it from me. And one of the things that I've found is when people first start waking up, there's certain people that are out there to collect people as they're waking up. There's certain people that are out there placed maybe strategically, maybe just coincidentally, but there's certain people out there that are at the forefront, the biggest mouthpieces in the movement, and their forms of communication are horrible. And people that find those people, because those are the ones that are out there in the forefront and they're the ones that you're going to find first, when you're first waking up, you don't have any other example of how to accomplish promoting these ideas except for that one or two people that you came across when you first woke up. But the problem is, when you woke up, it's because you were psychologically ready to wake up. You were looking for something. When the student's looking, the master appears. You were looking for something, and that's how you came across it, and therefore you were susceptible to it. So that person didn't have very much of a, you know, it wasn't very hard for them to convince you, because you were already looking for that anyways. When you're trying to talk to your mom or your brother or your cousin or your coworkers or your significant other or whatever it may be, those people are not looking to be woken up. So the same effect, the same approach that worked on you is not going to work on them. And people try to use the same approach that particular mouthpiece used on them, and they end up having it blow up in their face, and they end up looking crazy, and they end up losing friendships and losing relationships with their family members. And so one of the big things that I focus on the show is, how do you communicate with people? How do you get these ideas across without creating enemies, without creating those brick walls in between you and the other person? And I think that more importantly than anything else, if this message is going to continue to grow, the people that are out there communicating it need to have good communication skills. And nonviolent communications is one of the tools in my utility belt for communication that has had a tremendous impact on me being able to open people's eyes to things. And the Socratic method, I've learned a lot of stuff from what they say that Socrates taught on how to communicate, and the logical fallacies, the trivium method is another thing that I have found very valuable. So nonviolent communication, Socratic method, and trivium method are probably the three best tools that I found. So I spend a lot of time trying to teach those tools to other people that want to go out and make a difference in the world.
That's awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on and giving me an hour of your time today, Nathan. I really appreciate it. And I hope, I'm sure a lot of my listeners are going to enjoy it. How could people contact you or reach out to you or follow you? Yeah, if that makes sense.
You can always go to livefreefm.com. Livefreefm.com is where I put all of the archives, and I have some free literature there as well, talking about some of my experiences in the courts. And there's little Twitter and iTunes and whatever buttons at the top of the toolbar there. So you can subscribe on iTunes. You can follow me on Twitter. You can go to the Facebook page. Also, if you want to, you can, if you're on Facebook, you can just look up Nathan Frazier, and I'm the most famous Nathan Frazier. So I'll probably be I don't know if I'll be the first one that pops up, but look up Nathan Frazier and put in Live Free FM and I should probably pop up. So I don't ever not accept friend requests, because I have a low self-esteem and I need as many friends as possible.
I really felt special that you – I thought it was very selective in the process, so I'm a little bit disappointed now, Nathan. I'm just teasing. Well, thank you so much. Guys, I'm at Drew Sample, guys, if you don't already know this, which I'm sure you have, which I'm sure you do. And also, please follow at the Sample Hour. Join the Inspired Disorder Collective, www.inspireddisordercollective.com. Follow at IDC_updates. And thank you guys for tuning in to another episode of School of Thought. All right, bye.
All right, as promised, this is the bonus material for this week's episode of Live Free FM. The questions that I will be going over in this segment came directly from Mark Stevens at markstevens.net, markstevens.net. You can acquire the script that I'm going over in this segment directly from his website. It has these questions and many, many more. I personally have found Mark's approach to be one of the most effective out there and one of the most simple to understand, so I really like it, and I wanted to share this with you guys. Although I did end up losing this case, the audio from it is probably some of the best audio that I've gotten so far that explains and exemplifies how crooked some of these judges can be when it comes to taking your money for a victimless crime.
For the city of Fort Collins, Colorado. Please stand.
She has to pause and start over because I never stand when the judge enters the courtroom. Just my personal preference, but I don't respect these people. I don't respect their authority. I don't respect what they're doing, so I do not stand for them.
Municipal court for the city of Fort Collins, Colorado is now in session. Judge Kathleen M. Lane presiding.
So respect for the system issue.
Again, referring to the fact that I did not stand, but of course I do not have respect for their system.
All right, do you want to go ahead and step up to the podium there? For the record, it is November 8th of 2010. Are you Nathaniel Frazier?
I'm called that, yes.
All right, so you are here for arraignment on case number, or summons number P0006126. This is a camera radar red light summons and complaint. And the clerk had to review the written advisement form on this charge. This is from July 14th of 2010 as the date of violation listed on the summons. A charge of section 1101 subsection 1 of the city traffic code. And speeding 40 miles an hour in a 30 mile an hour zone, 10 miles over the posted limit is the specific charge. A 0 point defense because of the state law that relates to the camera radar red light type enforcement. So the the clerk had to review the advisement form with that 0 point speeding charge checked, and it looks like you reviewed that and indicated that you had questions that you wanted to ask with regard to your rights and options. So go ahead with your question.
So what she's speaking of is the consent form, or the form that they make you fill out saying that you understand your rights and you understand the proceedings. And of course, I don't, because all of it seems like a bunch of hogwash to me. So in order to get to the point where I can ask the judge the questions I want to ask, I usually take the approach of
I don't really understand this, and would I be able to speak with the judge in order to have full understanding so that I may enter a knowing and voluntary plea? This is usually fine with the clerk and usually fine with the judge because they have no idea what kind of questions I'm about to start asking.
Actually, I have questions pertaining to the nature and cause of these proceedings.
Okay, go ahead.
I would prefer to speak with the district attorney, but if I can just ask you my questions, is that okay?
That's fine.
Okay. First of all, am I entitled to a fair and meaningful hearing?
Yes.
Am I entitled to be informed of the nature and cause of the charges against me?
You are, and you have been in this written advisement form here.
Okay, am I entitled to responsive answers to any questions I might have about the charges?
Certainly. And let me back up a moment and say that the district attorney who you referenced does not handle municipal court cases.
Okay.
In municipal court, the prosecutor is from the city attorney's office and referred to as a municipal court prosecutor or assistant All right. city attorney.
So it's a city attorney then?
City attorney's office provides the prosecution, yes.
Okay. And is the burden of proof on the city attorney during these proceedings?
On the city, yes.
Okay. Is this court bound by Supreme Court rulings?
Certainly.
Okay, and is it bound by the constitutions of Colorado and the United States?
Certainly.
Okay. What rules, if any, govern these proceedings?
There are the Colorado Municipal Court Rules of Procedure that are adopted by the Colorado Supreme Court. There are also some procedural issues addressed in state statutes.
Okay, and you have to comply with all of these rules?
Certainly.
Okay.
There are also some provisions within the city code itself with regard to that apply to traffic infractions specifically, as well as camera radar cases.
So all of those questions were basically just to set her into a box that she wouldn't be able to work her way out of. I asked about the Constitution and the Supreme Court rulings to basically set it up to where she had to follow or be bound by the Constitution and the Supreme Court rulings, which of course she didn't, but she gave me lip service and said she would. I also asked her about whether I was entitled to be fully informed of the nature and cause of the charges and proceedings against me. And the reason that I ask her that is because once I start asking more questions that she doesn't want to answer, she's already put herself in the double bind where she said she couldn't get a plea from me unless I knew or I was fully informed. And if she refuses to answer my questions, she's refusing to make me fully informed or allow me to be fully informed. And thus she's putting herself in the position where she can't even accept a plea from me, which is eventually what happens.
And you said that this court is consistent with the Constitution's and Supreme Court rulings. Is the ticket that I was issued consistent with the Constitution's and Supreme Court rulings?
Well, you could certainly make an argument that it's not.
I'm not making an argument. I'm just asking a question.
This is something that they do to me all the time. They accuse me of arguing when all I'm doing is asking questions as if these people are not literate and do not understand the difference between a question and an argument. And she does this multiple times to me.
Well, that would be an argument that the city would need to respond to, the prosecution.
That's kind of why I wanted to talk to the prosecutor, actually.
So if there's some kind of motion you want to file, then the prosecution would need to be here to argue.
Well, I might move to dismiss, but I have a couple more questions I'd like to get answered, if that's okay.
And there she does a very classic diversionary tactic that they like to take. She knows damn well that the ticket is not consistent with the Constitution. It does not allege a violation of a known legal right. It does not allege any sort of injury. She knows that it's not consistent with Supreme Court rulings, which declare that a crime must have corpus delicti. And she knows that the ticket does not allege corpus delicti. But rather than answering the question honestly, she diverts me to the prosecutor, which is something that they like to do a lot. The judge will divert me to the prosecutor. The prosecutor will divert me to the police officer. It's always a game of handing you off to the next lowest man on the totem pole. So if you do get your case dismissed, they can blame it on the guy underneath them and avoid making themselves look bad.
Is there an allegation of injury with this particular citation?
injury to an individual?
Is it an allegation of injury at all?
I would have to have the prosecution respond to that question.
Okay.
All I have is the face of the ticket itself, charging a speeding violation. No indication that there's any kind of accident.
And how does a plaintiff acquire standing in this court?
And I ask that question because it's been ruled multiple times by higher courts that in order to acquire standing, a plaintiff needs to allege a violation of one of their rights. And they need to allege that because of that violation, they suffered some sort of injury, and thus they are entitled to some sort of damages or monetary compensation. And none of that is alleged on this ticket. She is, of course, aware that according to case law, the requirements for standing have not been met, so she defers me to statutory law in a way to get around that.
The city files a summons and complaint. One of the officers, in this case, the ticket indicates it's Officer Dennis Hallberg who signed it, badge number FCC 140.
Okay, and will I be allowed to cross-examine that officer if it does come to a proceeding?
If you plead not guilty and the case is set for trial, the city would certainly have the officer here to testify, yes, and you would have the opportunity to cross-examine. It does indicate that on the rights on that written advisement form that you reviewed. Number 5 says at trial to testify or not, to present evidence and cross-examine witnesses with the city.
Okay. Apologize. Most of these questions that I came up with were actually geared towards the district attorney or the prosecuting attorney.
Again, this is my first time trying this approach that I learned from Mark, and I was not completely prepared as I did not exactly know what to expect, so I did make a few mistakes, and I went in there with the wrong armament for the wrong situation, but I made the best out of the situation that I could.
And you said he has the burden of proof in this. Does he have the burden of proof on every element of this crime?
The city has the burden of proof, yes, okay, with regard to the charge itself and all the elements.
And going into this, am I presumed innocent of the crime?
Certainly.
And am I presumed innocent of every element of the crime?
Certainly.
And is not jurisdiction an element of the crime?
Certainly.
So am I presumed innocent of jurisdiction then?
The city would have to allege, the city would allege, as they have in the summons and complaint, and have to prove that the incident happened within the city of Fort Collins.
Okay. I'm not really a lawyer. I don't really understand most of this. I just need a yes or no. Am I presumed innocent of jurisdiction of this crime?
This is a question that she does not want to answer. The reason being is that if she admits that she presumes to not have jurisdiction, if she admits that she presumes me innocent of every element, including jurisdiction, that is basically her saying that she presumes not to be able to even hear the case. It's a fatal flaw in their system. It's necessary to uphold the veil of legitimacy that they have this propaganda, that they tell you that you're presumed innocent. They do not presume you innocent, but they tell you that they do. And when you look at just the jurisdiction element of the crime, it is obvious that they do not presume you innocent. But they will say so, and when you hold their feet to their fire, they get very uncomfortable.
That's an unusual way to form the question. That's why I'm struggling. But that is an element of the offense that the city has to prove.
And so I am presumed innocent of jurisdiction.
You are presumed innocent of the charge itself.
So I'm not presumed innocent of all the elements of the crime. I just need to understand this before I go forward.
It's such an unusual question. I'm not sure how to answer it any differently than I already have.
Just with the yes or no.
I have to laugh at this point because most people, when they go into court with me and they see the way that I talk to judges and the way that I put them in their place, they're completely astonished and amazed. But just remember, these are people, and they're the lowest form of people. They're crooks. They're people that like to make their living off of stealing and bullying. And it's hard to talk to somebody who makes their living that way with any amount of respect. Most people do it out of fear. I don't really fear these people. will continue.
Well, I've already said you are presumed innocent of the charge. One of the elements of the charge is that it happened within the city of Fort Collins. So you're presumed innocent of the charge and all the elements thereof.
Okay, so if I'm presumed innocent of jurisdiction, does this court have the ability to proceed against me?
Yes, because the allegation is that it happened within the city of Fort Collins, and so it's appropriate to go ahead and proceed with the summons and complaint presented as it has been.
And if you listen to that last clip, you can tell that she's been caught on her lie, and she knows she's been caught, and you can hear the fear and the trembling in her voice, the choppiness in her voice. This is what happens when you stand up to a bully.
And who has to prove that I'm within the city of Fort Collins?
The city is the prosecution.
Prosecution.
That evidence.
And do they have any facts on record to prove that I'm, even right now, within the city limits of Fort Collins?
Do they have any facts on record to prove that you're in the city of Fort Collins?
Uh-huh.
The prosecution would have to respond to that type of question.
See, most of these questions actually...
You're getting into the charge itself. If you want to ask that the arraignment date be postponed for 2 weeks so you have time to file a written motion and the city can respond, and then we determine whether that motion is granted or not, and if not, if the motion to dismiss is denied, then it would be set for trial, and then you can have a trial on the charge itself if you choose.
Again, the question is too difficult for her to answer, so once again, I am deferred to the prosecutor. And that's her way of keeping herself out of the spotlight. We'll continue.
Okay. You already said that I am entitled to a fair and meaningful hearing, right?
Yes.
Okay. Could I get a fair and meaningful hearing if there was a conflict of interest?
I would assume you would argue no.
Again, she accuses me of arguing when I'm asking a question, and she says she assumes I would argue no, as if anybody would argue that yes, a judge with a conflict of interest could offer a fair trial.
No, I'm asking you what the answer is. I'm not going to argue about it.
Well, what kind of conflict of interest are you talking about?
Well, if you represented a party to the proceedings, would that be a conflict of interest?
Certainly, I would not do that. And if there were any conflict that I had, I would recuse myself.
So you heard her say it, folks. She said that if she represented a party to the proceeding, it would be a conflict. And if that conflict existed, she would recuse herself.
Okay, you would recuse yourself. So you wouldn't seek to enforce any judgment against me if there was found to be a conflict of interest?
If there was a... I'm not sure what you mean.
If there was a conflict of interest...
we would deal with the conflict, okay. Remove the conflict before the case ever went to trial.
Okay.
If you go to trial, you're found guilty, then the court would enforce the judgment until
right.
Collect the judgment.
And who do you represent in these proceedings?
I am hired by the city of Fort Collins as the municipal judge.
Okay, and who's the plaintiff in these proceedings?
It is the city of Fort Collins. It's stated as...
Oh, snap. She just said she represents the city of Fort Collins and is paid for by the city of Fort Collins. And when I asked her who the plaintiff to the proceedings was, she said that the plaintiff is also the city of Fort Collins. She realizes that she just admitted that she represents and is paid for by a party to the proceedings. And let's see how she tries to get out of this. A lot of backpedaling, a lot of stuttering, maybe? Let's find out.
See how they specifically has it worded. It's a charge, again, defendant, they allege that it's a charge committed against the people of the city of Fort Collins. At the top, it's in Fort Collins Municipal Court and for the city of Fort Collins. So it's city attorney's office representing the city of Fort Collins in general.
So you're being paid by the city, and the plaintiff is the city. And is that not a conflict of interest?
Not a conflict of interest.
It's not a conflict of interest? What is this bitch, crazy? She represents a party to the proceeding. She just 2 seconds ago said if she represents a party to the proceeding, it would be a conflict of interest. And now all of a sudden, it is not a conflict of interest.
In the county and district court systems, you're going to find a similar situation. It's the taxpayers that are paying the judge as well as the taxpayers paying the prosecution, which is a public official.
So you're saying on the record, the fact that you're getting paid by the plaintiff is not a conflict of interest?
I am saying that.
Now, at this point, I should have had her explain how it could possibly not be a conflict of interest for her to represent and be paid for by a party to a proceeding. But this was my first time, and like I said, I made mistakes. So I continue.
Okay. Is this being recorded at all?
Yes.
And will I be... Is there ability for me to get a transcript or audio recording or something of this whole proceeding?
You can do that. You are recording it?
Yes, I am.
Okay. And you said that it does have to stay consistent with Supreme Court rulings. The Supreme Court rules that in order for a plaintiff to have standing to complain against somebody, that they have to prove or plead an injury personal to themselves. And I'm not seeing any injury, and you stated that you're not aware of any injury being pled here.
And what I said is that the prosecution would have to address that. I'm going to stop you at this point because I think this really, a lot of what you're getting at is more appropriate in a motion to dismiss, and I'm going to ask that you do that in writing.
Can I just
so that
orally
the prosecution can,
and
no, because
the
prosecutors
right
are involved with pretrial conferences right now, so they're not available, and they would need time to review the case. So typically a motion to dismiss like this, I would ask that it be in writing, so I'm going to ask that in this case.
Okay.
And I'll ask that the bailiff have the clerk go ahead and postpone the arraignment for 2 weeks. Give you time if you want to file a written motion to dismiss.
Okay.
Prosecutor will respond, and then I'll rule on it.
At this point in time, you can pretty much tell she just wants me to get the F out of her courtroom. She wants to get rid of me. She does not want to answer any more of my questions, and she keeps avoiding and putting me off to the prosecutor. And this is typical. This is usually what I get. As soon as I start asking any questions that get at the heart of what they're doing, this is usually the response I get. Get out of my courtroom. I don't need to answer these questions.
And if I do put in a motion to dismiss, do I give it to you and to the prosecutor, or just to the prosecutor?
You would file it with the court and give a copy to the prosecutor. And the copy filed with the court should indicate that you have given a copy to the other side, which in this case is the prosecution.
All right, and if I do make out a motion to dismiss, does the prosecutor have to address each issue that I bring up in the motion in order for you to deny it, or I don't really understand?
It depends. Sometimes they will address each individual item. Sometimes they will give a general response. Sometimes if they feel that all of the items really relate to factual issues that are to be determined at trial, they'll just indicate that and ask that the motion be denied. It depends. That would be up to the prosecution as to how they respond to the motion.
And just for good measure, because I'm still confused on how she can represent a party and it not be a conflict of interest, I ask one more time.
Okay. And just one more last time, just so I'm 100% sure about this. You're saying that you are paid by the plaintiff, but that is not a conflict of interest.
And I've already answered that question.
Can I just get a yes or a no?
I'll have you go with the bailiff at this point.
Okay. All right, you have a good day.
You too.
So in recap, this judge proves herself to have a lot of patience, and thus I get to ask a lot of questions, which is why I really like this audio. And also, she proves herself to be quite a liar and quite a manipulator of words and circumstances, which is also why I really like this audio. A few things that I do differently now, I make them explain. If they say something and it doesn't make sense to me, I demand that they explain. If she says, or if any judge says, it's not a conflict of interest, I hold their feet to the fire. I say, how could it not be a conflict of interest? If they say, well, the city has to prove this, I'll ask them, what do you mean when you say the city? What exactly is the city? What are you talking about? I don't let them just get away with using these words that have nothing to refer to them. I want them to give me the referent. I want to understand what they're saying. They need a voluntary and fully understood plea. I want to fully understand. Also, I don't beat them over the head. Usually I've found, since this incident, I have found that it's better just to get in, get out, make my point real quick, and let the cards fall where they may. If I've gotten through the first set of questions and a judge doesn't throw it out right then, beating them over the head with the facts is probably not the most effective thing to do. Continually trying to push them and force them is probably just going to get them more and more defensive. So I usually only go in with one set of questions now. What I like to go in with that I didn't go in with this particular time and what I found to be most effective, at least at the judge level, is just to simply ask, Your Honor, is this court bound by the Constitution and Supreme Court rulings? They'll usually say yes, and then I'll say, okay, would I have to enter a plea if there wasn't a crime presented? And since there's not a crime presented, I've never had them answer that question once. Usually it's continuance or dismissed. But these are the things that you learn. Subsequently, I learned that when you go in there and beat a judge over the head with the fact that they're a fraud, then every time you go before that judge again, as is the case with this lady, they usually don't care. The last time I went before this lady, I had cops, like 6 or 7 cops in the courtroom taking pictures of me. I got a ticket in the parking lot of the court while I was in there. And when I was leaving the court, I got followed by 5 or 6 police cars and ticketed again for the exact same infraction that they ticketed me for while I was in court. So this judge was very threatened by this, and I would only be able to say that the reason I believe that they feel so threatened that they go to such extreme measures is because their entire lifestyle, their entire reality is built on a house of cards. Their authority is built on a house of cards. When you start questioning them, it's like pulling out one of the bottom cards, and pretty soon their entire reality comes falling down. And when that happens, and when the people realize that the emperor has no clothes, these people are going to have to go out and get real jobs. These people are going to have to get jobs where they get paid on a voluntary basis like the rest of us. And most of these people have no idea how to do anything except for bully people and steal from them. And there's not much need for that in the job market. So they need to hold on to their positions of authority because otherwise they are useless to society. And that's got to be a pretty scary position to be in. So don't expect them to go down without a fight.
We have pure imagination, they have books for masturbation. We have resolution, they have bombs to sink a nation. Maybe that's why the nation's falling. Maybe that's why the earth is calling. Maybe that's why the nation's falling down. Down just a little bit more.